Up next, a very interesting conversation I'm going to have. And just to give you an idea of how this memoir has been received thus far, Justice Albie Sachs had the following to say: an exquisitely written memoir about human endurance, survival, repair, and transcendence. Whereas Johnny Steinberg, famous author, says, "When they came for me is many things. The tale of an ordinary young man swept one day from his life into hell. Testimony to the wickedness a political system let loose in its agents. And above all, an intimate account of how a man became a healer." And I think that's a wonderful starting point to start off the conversation and introduce our guest. On for tonight's profile interview, we are joined by John R. And I'm going to try my best with your surname. If I get it wrong, you'll let me know there, John. It's Sklepoberski. Is it Sklepoberski?
You've got it right, yeah.
Oh, thank goodness. my heart skipped a couple of beats there. Award-winning author and consultant, psychotherapist, on his compelling life as based on his recently published book, When They Came For Me, The Hidden Diary of an Apartheid Prisoner. Now, good evening to you, and thank you for joining us and sharing in your story this evening.
Good evening to you, and thank you for inviting me. I'm honored to be with you.
So, as with so many of our leaders in the past, your journey goes back all the way to 1969, when you were a student at Wits University, and you were arrested for opposing apartheid. Please do tell us the story at the time, because we obviously know that we had a very active state security mechanism in place at the time. And that, with all due respect, these guys, they singled out people, they hunted them down, they found them, and all too often secreted them away.
Indeed. Well, I was a second year student at Wits, and all of 21 years old, mm-hmm. when an administrator came into our lecture theatre one Friday morning, and he didn't know me any more than I knew him. Uh-huh. And he called out. He said, "Is there a Mr. Sklepoberski in here?" Now, I don't remember exactly where the lecture theatre was, but I would like one day to revisit it again. Uh-huh. And I put my hand up, thinking something had happened. There was a crisis in my family. Who knows? And he said, there's somebody outside waiting to see you. Uh-huh. So that's when they came for me. I walked out, he disappeared, and there were three plainclothes detectives who were introduced by their leader. Mm-hmm. He named himself. I can't remember his name. And he said, I recognized him, actually. He was part of a team that used to do surveillance on us at Wits if we had demonstrations.
Ah.
And he said, I'm arresting you under the Terrorist Act. Come with me. And they made a scrum around me and marched me off the campus. And that was my arrest.
Wow. And what was this for? I mean, I guess at the time, as you said, you were, I take it that as a student, you were active in politics, that you had obviously made a stance specifically against a repressive apartheid government. But what was this tipping point for them to go from surveying you during these protests all the way to saying, now we're going to take him in?
Well, it wasn't one thing, because, in fact, I didn't do anything that warranted this kind of treatment.
Mm.
But I asked myself that question for the next 55 days, actually. Why? And, in fact, I was hoping to find in the state records, in the National Archive, some further indication of what it was that had led to my arrest. There was no single catalyst, and they gave nothing away. So I took them to my home. Mm-hmm. They said to me, take us to where you live. I had no idea. They didn't even know where I lived. That's why they came for me at Wits. And they took the place to pieces, searched every nook and cranny for books, documents, details. They took away two typewriters, a whole carload of stuff, and took me to Pretoria. They kept insisting I would see a lawyer, and I kept saying, I want to see a lawyer. They said, you'll see a lawyer when you come to Pretoria. Instead, they put me in front of a man named Tuanis Swanepoel. He was the chief interrogator of the day. And he and his team, by the time I got there, were going through my things on a big table in a big interrogation center in the Compol building, the Commissioner of Police building. It's a big stone building on the side of Church Square. It used to be Paul Kruger's bank. It's still a police museum, actually. And on this side of it, on the one side of it, were a whole series of interrogation rooms and a big open space where they were going through my stuff. And they went for me in the most terrifying way. I don't know where the chutzpah came from. I can be a cheeky guy when it comes to threatening authorities. And I didn't really know who he was. You know, he was already notorious in the press. Many people had died at his hands under interrogation. He went on to become the commanding officer responsible for the massacres in the Soweto riots. So he became a notorious figure. Anyway, this was in the early days of his notoriety. So I didn't know who I was speaking to. And I said, excuse me, but if you want me to answer your questions, please would you speak to me in English?
Yeah.
And this provoked the most terrible rage. He went for me because I didn't speak Afrikaans on Sotar. You live here, you fucking Jews. You come here and you live in the hidden parts of our society and you do terrible things to us. And you say you don't even speak our language. This is the gist of what he had to say. And they took me into a little interrogation room, shut all the steel doors on the window parts, and assembled a crew in front of me who all screamed and shouted for a long time, as if they were I thought they were going to kill me there and then. But at no stage did they ask me a specific question. They were there to terrorize me, and indeed they did. Then one of them, a detective named Richter, Harvey Richter, I think it's important to name these people, he put a brick down on the floor in front of me and told me to stand on it. Well, when he got the brick out, I thought he was going to hit me with it. And I can still remember the detail of this brick held to my face, you know, to show me what he was going to use to hurt and frighten me. Put it on the floor very quietly in front of me, and he said, stand on it. Now, I've never stood on a brick before. And it was a weird thing to tell somebody to do, so I didn't. So then they all started beating me and shouting again. So I got on the brick, and they said, you'll stand there till you tell us what you know we want to hear.
Wow.
And that's where I stood, on and off, for 5 days and six nights.
Wow.
It went on relentlessly. They made a team of six interrogators, Swanepoel and his interrogation partner, Javi Richter, another detective named Trevor Baker and his interrogation partner, whose name is lost in the mists of time, and then a third team of two, also whose names I can't retrieve from memory. So one team would interrogate me for 4 hours, just going at me, often without stating any specific question, insisting I respond and tell them about me, my life, who I'd been meeting. There are certain things they knew, but not very much. After 4 hours, they would go, another 4 hours would come with another two, and then another two for another 4 hours. And then at the end of 12 hours, they complete a cycle, they start again. And so it went from Friday afternoon until the following Wednesday lunchtime.
Jeez.
And I have to confess, by the end of it, I still didn't know exactly what they were on about. Now, my associations were completely against apartheid. I'd grown up in Joburg. And in fact, it's nice to hear a kind of Joburg accent in your voice, Kashwa, because you speak like I remember, you know, me and my family and friends speaking.
Yes, yeah.
And always when I hear an accent from your part of the world, I feel at home. So I'd grown up in Joburg, and when I was 11, we moved to Swaziland. And the reason we went there was twofold. The one was my parents both came from Jewish families whose parents had come from Lithuania, where Jews were not allowed to own land. It was prohibited.
Mm-hmm.
And so when my grandparents arrived and did reasonably well, the first thing they did was buy farms. So my mother grew up on one farm. My father helped with his father's farm. But they wouldn't go farming in the Transvaal, where we lived, because they were turned against by the Afrikaans neighbors. They were Uitlanders, Jewish people who the Afrikaners didn't want to have amongst them.
Yeah.
So when we could, we moved to farm in Swaziland. And they wanted to take us away from apartheid. And they raised us in Swaziland.
Uh-huh.
According to humanitarian principles of value and equality.
Yeah.
So when I came back to study at WITS, I was quite rebellious, but in a most personal of ways. So I wasn't planning a revolution and I wasn't doing anything underground, but I was certainly doing a lot of things illegal. Like I had friends of mine, black friends from different townships who I met in different ways, who'd come to visit me at my home. Some of them stayed over at night at times. I had parties where there was mixed race people.
Yeah.
We had drink at these parties. That was against the law. We violated many of the primary features of a petty apartheid. And when these security policemen were interrogating me and discovering that I was living the kind of life I live in London now, I have no regard to what color my friends are. You know, it's not an issue.
Mm.
But for them, it was wild, really. They called me Declan Yueki, the little Jew boy. And they would talk to each other in Afrikaans in front of me. In fact, when they started the interrogation,
yeah,
and they went for me in Afrikaans, I said to Swanepoel, "Excuse me, sir, but if you want me to answer your questions, please would you speak to me in English, because I don't understand what you're saying."
Yeah.
And that was the first provocation. You know, he went from, it was like giving blood to a shark to tell this man.
Yeah, yeah.
But then, I mean, my mother comes from an Afrikaans farming community. She was called an Afrikaans Inuit, and she spoke Afrikaans fluently. It was her first language at school. She spoke Yiddish in her home,
sure,
my grandparents' language, and Afrikaans at school, and English was her third language. So we had a lot of Afrikaans in our home and lots of phrases and quaint sayings. And it was very familiar to me, and I understood what these interrogators were saying to each other, although they didn't realize.
Mm.
So I could monitor some of what they were doing. And they would talk to each other about Declan Yueki. And they would, one would say to another, "What are you doing in NUSAS, the National Union of South African Students, or the SRC?" And I would say, "No, I don't, I'm not in NUSAS, and yeah, I'm not in the SRC." And then the one who said this would start screaming at me to tell the truth. And then his boss, Swanepoel, would say to him, "Ach nee, die communist is nie in NUSAS nie. Hij is het achterkant. He's the communist sits behind, you know.
Yeah,
he's not in front."
So in other words, they sort of using you as a tool, as a puppet, for lack of a better term.
Well, no, the point they were making, I was discovering, was that there was no evidence against me. But the less evidence, the more convinced they were that I was hiding something and part of an underground piece of machinery. And that's why they went for me in this way. Now, my arrest took place in the context of a whole series of arrests in the winter of 1969. Now, for people who've lived through the much more bitter, bloody years of the struggle in the 1970s and 80s, it's hard to believe that in that period, you know, the first years after the Rivonia trial, I was arrested in June 1969. So just 5 years after all these people had been sent to Robben Island, and the security services had really smashed the underground opposition. Sobukwe for the PAC was on Robben Island. Mandela and the other ANC people were on Robben Island.
Mm.
There were people in Pretoria Central Prison. The lid was on very tight, and there was very little opposition to the apartheid government. And at that time, the apartheid government was bitterly divided within itself. between Afrikaners who called themselves die Verlichters, who wanted to have television, who wanted to legalize the newspapers of other countries, and the Verkramters, who insisted that we had to have church services on the radio every day. You couldn't have anything so ungodly as television. And they were fighting each other. I learned all this when I was released and came to London a year later and met people who informed me on what these arrests had arisen from. And so Forster, who was then the Prime Minister, he wasn't yet the President, he instructed his leading team of Veiligheidspolitie to do a trawl right around the country and arrest every black intellectual they could lay their hands on, every leader within the black world. By black, I mean Indian, coloured, African. Yeah. So they arrested Winnie Mandela, Joyce Kakane. They went on to arrest Peter Magubane. They arrested a lot of people in the Cape, in Cape Town, a lot of people in the Eastern Cape. But there were no leads they were following because actually people were very quiet, wisely so, because the security system was so tight. But they were not looking for leads. What they were looking to do was have a show trial in order to frighten the Afrikaners and say, die swart gevaar is gevaarlijk. The red peril is very dangerous. The black peril is very dangerous. We've got to come together. We can't fight each other. So 6 months after all these arrests took place, they had a big show trial. They put Winnie Mandela and Joyce Kakane on trial with 20 others. The leading evidence all came from people who they had tortured, as they tortured me. The judge threw the case out halfway through because the evidence was so flimsy and was based on people who were evidently victims of torture. No trouble to the police. They rearrested all the defendants in the dock on the day in the old synagogue in Pretoria, which was the place for the trial. And they put them back into solitary confinement for another 6 months and brought them to trial yet again. And at the second trial, the judge ruled that this was called double jeopardy. You can't put people on trial and on different charges using the same evidence. And he threw it out for a second time and they had to release them all. But it had served its purpose. It had helped to bring the divided world of African society together against the peril they claimed was at their door. And for somebody like myself, whose primary association in terms that threatened them was literature and writing, they were very embarrassed by my arrest. And what they did in my case was give me two options. You can stay here in solitary confinement in Pretoria Prison until the trial is over, and it's going to take 6 months or a year. Or you can leave. We're going to take you from here and deport you. And I selected the second option. So after 55 days, 50 of which were spent in solitary confinement in the hanging jail, they took me to the airport, gave me half an hour to say goodbye to my mother and father, brother and sister, my partner. And that was the end of it. I could never come home again. Yeah, so that's the story.
So while away, I mean, where did you go off to, and what happened to you at that stage? I mean, was it a case of saying, listen, this was a country that never loved me anyway? I mean, in fact, I grew up in Swaziland because of the, I almost said verkrampt, you know, because it's the term that you used, but because of the racism, the innate racism and hatred that you had received in the first place. And then here you are, you're a student, you're fighting the system, and then you get treated this way. I mean, 55 days of torture. Did you abandon this country and say, stuff these people, I'm going to build my life and move on? End of story.
Well, the story's never over because here I am. I'm speaking to you now. My book has just come out. It's taken me 52 years to write it, which is a pity. But It is a terrible story. It nearly destroyed me. You know, the worst part wasn't even the interrogation, as dreadful as it was. It was the period in solitary confinement, listening to the men in the condemned cells singing before their executions at night.
Wow, yeah.
You know, I didn't really know where I was when I woke up after all the sleep deprivation they put me in the prison. And on my first day there, after I slept round the clock for 24 hours and woke up very bewildered and found that there was writing on the walls of my cell by people who were waiting for their executions. And then I understood. But that night, as the sun was setting, it was wintertime in June in Pretoria. But even Pretoria gets cold in the winter if you're inside a prison.
Huh.
And it was very chilly. And then as the sun began to set, I heard this beautiful singing from far away. It wasn't so far, but I couldn't hear the words exactly. And it consoled me through the night. And it started up again before dawn, early in the morning. Then it stopped. And it went on like this day after day. And then one of the warders taking me out for a shower one morning, he was a youngster. He was even younger than me. You know, I was only 21.
Yeah.
And this guy, young Afrikaans warder, he was so young, he hadn't even started to shave. He was like a schoolboy in his big, smart prison uniform. And when he came to collect me for the shower, I could see he was crying. And on the way to the shower, I said to him, "Meneer, it's verkeerd. Is anything wrong?" And he said to me in Afrikaans, because, you know, I didn't hide the fact that I could converse in Afrikaans then. He said, "The Kaffir we hanged this morning was even younger than me. It's such a shame."
Wow.
He couldn't cope with his own emotion. He was officiating at the hanging of a youngster.
And he was a kid himself.
He was a kid himself. Now, this is the gross inhumanity of the system as it was.
Huh.
But I read the words of this other man on the walls of my prison cell. His name, and I want to share it with your listeners, because who knows, there may be people listening. This may be have been the grandfather of somebody or the great uncle of somebody, because it's a long time ago now.
Yeah.
The wording on the cell wall said Knox Massey, his name, K-N-O-X, and then M-A-S-I, Knox Massey. And then it said, "For murder, I was sentenced." And I could see from the way he spelled murder, M-U-D-E-R, he was struggling with English, you know. He left out one of the letters. Now, but he didn't finish his sentence. My guess is he really finished his sentence. They came to take him away for execution. And I wrote a poem to this man in the wall on the back cover of the little Bible I had in the cell.
Mm-hmm.
And the poem took the meaning of his words to be like the words of the prophet Daniel, who's in the prison cell in Babylon.
Yeah.
And it's believed that he can decipher the writing on the wall of the great palace of Nebuchadnezzar. So he's brought out, and he reads the writing on the wall, and the writing says, "These walls and their king will perish." And I took his words to mean the doom of apartheid. Mm. And it's come about. So you can hear from what I'm saying to you, South Africa is still my home.
Mm-hmm.
I'm very connected to the people and the struggle, and have always been.
I hear you. And I mean, it's thanks to people like yourselves who kept that going, that flame burning. And I mean, obviously it was the efforts of so many people, but at the same time, it was people like yourselves who were outside of the country who were able to obviously highlight what was going on here, when you have the Verkramdes busy fighting over the fact on whether we should allow TV to enter the country or not. And it's crazy. It's absolutely crazy to think that we went through that particular period. What was your activism like outside of South Africa during this particular period? Because I guess that's always a fascinating window to peer through. You know, where you're not able to, inverted commas, fight at home, but, you know, you're outside of the country, and how do you then fight this repressive regime that the West at the time is very quiet over and supportive over, actually, because why they happen to be suppressing the commies, isn't it?
Absolutely. And the West was making a lot of money out of apartheid, not just from the Golden Diamonds, but the huge industrial conglomerate that the South African industrial complexes were. Hmm. Well, you know, fortunately for me, I came to a city, London, that had a long history of anti-apartheid support. And the history came from the fact that this had been a base from which the liberation movements had located themselves. So there were people here closely associated with the Congress movement, the South African Communist Party, and the African National Congress. Mm. And you know, through my early associations in Johannesburg, my own family had family connections to these movements. And I went to meet first with Albie Sachs and his then wife, Stephanie. And they introduced me to the Defense and Aid Fund. It was properly called the International Defense and Aid Fund. They were raising money to support legal cases to protect political prisoners. I didn't really appreciate quite how much else they were doing, but they were very involved in the underground struggle.
Yeah.
And the Defense and Aid Fund secured a scholarship to help me. You know, I arrived with nothing as a refugee with no resources and no funds anywhere, really. But I got a scholarship from an organization I like to name because it, you know, does represent critical steps in the opposition. It was called the International University Exchange Fund. Mm-hmm. And this was money that came from the governments of Denmark, Sweden, and Norway, who uh-huh. combined together to put up an international fund to educate opponents of apartheid who came out of the country. Mm-hmm. And they were also supporting the International Defense and Aid Fund. So they were also funneling resources into the country to help with pay for legal services to protect people on trial. So mm-hmm. there were sources of comfort and connection. Through them, I was introduced to the Observer newspaper. And during the course of the second trial of the people amongst whom I was arrested, I wrote a lengthy article about how I'd been interrogated and how I'd been tortured. And the content of this article corroborated the detail that the legal team in Johannesburg were documenting to call into question the testimony of the state witnesses in the trial.
Wow.
My article in The Observer came out just as the trial was reaching its zenith, really, and it stood in support of those people in detention. So I was able to play some small and modest part in mounting opposition on their behalf. I continued with the anti-apartheid movement for quite some time in different ways and on different terms. In later years, I finished my training as a psychotherapist. And what I committed myself to doing, because, you know, I couldn't come back and I wanted to be able to go forward in those ways I could.
Yeah.
I also needed to support and protect my family, who were at risk in South Africa, exposed and also under surveillance in different ways. So I got involved with an organization with an international focus on the protection of political refugees who've suffered trauma or torture at the hand of the state or different kinds of parastatal organizations. Yeah. And I helped to set up an organization which, at the time, we called the Medical Foundation for the Care and Treatment of Victims of Torture. We set it up in 1985, so it's been going for nearly 40 years now. Huh. And it's now called Freedom from Torture. It's a major UK charity that does a lot of international work. And I spent 25 years working in the front line there with refugees from many different parts of the world.
Yeah, yeah.
And the book that I got the award for, it's called From the Couch to the Circle, Group Analytic Psychotherapy in Practice. It's a textbook in group psychotherapy. And it's illustrated with stories taken from these many years of work at the organization. And I continue to do this work. So, for example, I'm really on the front edge of a big endeavor in London amongst mental health organizations to address Black Lives Matter and racial injustice and institutional racism in UK life and practice. So the struggle continues. And the right, and the extreme right in particular, are always at our doorstep. And I maintain a position of steadfast opposition against them.
Sure.
Amongst the very touching things that have affected me in the period since I've been writing this book, but also before, is a new and changed relationship with Afrikaans and Afrikaans-speaking people.
Uh-huh.
So, on the occasion of Nelson Mandela's inauguration in April 1994,
yes,
we were watching this extraordinary event from on television here, and Mandela took his oath of office, and then Thabo Mbeki took his oath of office, both in English. And then when de Klerk took his oath of office, he put his hand on what I think must have been his family Bible.
Mm-hmm.
And he took his oath of office in Afrikaans. And he wept as he did so. And watching, I began to cry also.
Mm.
Now, I don't know the man. I do know that he's not an entirely straightforward guy. You know, he was not all he wanted to appear.
Yeah.
But I saw his deep, deep emotion. And it changed something for me, because until then, if I heard Afrikaans spoken, let's say I came across Afrikaans-speaking people in the street in London,
yes,
I'd go and walk on the other side of the road. I hated the language and its speakers.
Mm-hmm.
It was the language of the policemen. It was the language of the Black Mariahs. And it was the language of the police and the language of my torturers.
Exactly, yeah.
But in that moment, something changed. And it's continued to change. And when, for example, I asked one of my close friends here in London, he's an Afrikaans-speaking man, a psychoanalyst who works in the same field that I do, and I asked him to check the text of the Afrikaans in my book.
Mm.
Asked him, you know, do a review of the Afrikaans. He did so, and he made some very valuable amendments and you know, got the stuff corrected. And when he passed it back to me, he said under his breath as he did so, "What evil was committed by our people in the name of Christianity?"
Mm.
And he was just overwhelmed, really, reading about the daily progression of the executions in Pretoria prison.
Yeah,
I felt the depth of his sincerity and sorrow. And more recently still, I organized a big book launch for my book, and we did it online. So because of the pandemic, we could only have a few people at the event. And
yeah,
we were given, for this theater, we were given a maximum of 40 people. So we had to leave out a lot of people. So, in fact, my family, there's a big family. I'm from a big family. There were 26 of us were family. It's like a tribe, really. And then we had, you know, just 10 or 15 other people. And then the rest went out online. And incorporated in the launch were a series of songs from the years of the struggle. And I'd been going through the different songs to find recordings to incorporate in the launch. So we had a beautiful recording of Senzanina, the UCT Youth Choir. And then that wonderful, memorable recording of Asimbonangu Mandela, when Johnny Clegg sings it on the stage in Paris, and Mandela comes out from behind. We had that song, Pasopa Fervurt, the black man is coming, beware.
Hmm.
And we concluded with a recording of Nkosi Sikalele that's sung by 1,000 voices. And I wanted this out, you know, to show people in different parts of the world who South Africans are and how people have come together and how the country's been transformed. Now, this was a very moving thing, and a lot of people who look at this book launch are educated about the years of this struggle, really for the first time. But amongst the songs I searched for, I came across something quite unexpected. And this relates to the story of Afrikaans. It's a song sung by Stellenbosch University Choir called Die Donker.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sung by a choir put together by André van der Merwe, the choir director, under conditions of pandemic. So each person sings the music in their own room.
Wow.
Privately, yeah. And he puts it all together.
Jeez.
It's extraordinary and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
The song comes from a contemporary Afrikaans folk song, and his André van der Merwe has enriched it and created out of it a song full of metaphor and beauty. And to see a mixed choir from Stellenbosch, which was the heartland of white Afrikaansdom, and hear the choir of black, colored, Indian, white people, completely mixed, singing in this beautifully pronounced Afrikaans, you know, wonderfully enunciated Afrikaans.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a song that says, "En die donker gang, daar's 'n lig wat skyn, maar die vlam is delicate en fyn." In the dark passage, there's a small flame, but the flame is delicate and fine. And it's all about op my ooms se plaas sonder elektrisiteit.
Hmm.
We grew up on a farm without electricity. And it reminds me, you know, of my childhood. And in the song, the singers tell this child who's frightened to be in the passage, in the dark passage, in the darkness, don't be frightened, my child. There's love, and love will come. And the wind may blow and the storm may break, but there's light. And the sense of the passage of light, you know, even for the Afrikaans people who've been the agents of such terror and who have come through this to undergo the kind of transformation that we've seen, it gives hope for all kinds of things to happen.
Wow.
So, you know, when I put the song on and I watch and I sing with them here in London, it's very moving.
Absolutely. It is so profound and it's so touching. And, you know, I can't help but think to myself, it's just such a beautiful, you know, revolution. And you know, that there, where, as you said, there was this point in your life where if you heard Afrikaans, you would walk on the other side of the street because it represented the language of your oppressors and the oppressors of your people. And now at your book launch, you know, there's this beautiful Afrikaans song that resonates with you on such a deep level. I mean, it's just absolutely stunning. And, you know, I can't help but think to myself that, you know, today you're not sitting, you know, you're not speaking to me as a former parliamentarian, as a minister, as a, you know, as a person that sort of went through the struggle for reward, for lack of better, you know, for lack of a better term. You're a healer in the true sense of the word, based on the work that you're doing, working with you know, having worked with refugees that have gone through trauma. And believe me, it's something I've seen. It's something that really is quite shocking and difficult for people to deal with, getting the proper psychosocial support and so on. You know, what was at the end of that dark tunnel for you? What was your light at the end of the dark tunnel? Fighting against apartheid, whether here or abroad?
That's a touching question. Let me offer you some words. You know, it is extraordinary because, you know, this kind of work, it exposes us to the stories of humanity, both the beauty and the horror. One of our first clients at this organization we set up called the Medical Foundation was a young school teacher from Iran. Now, this is going back a long way. you know, we were working in 1985.
Yeah.
The Iranian Revolution took place in 1979. It was first a democratic revolution led by a group called the Mujahideen. They were democratic Muslims who brought down and toppled the government of the Shah. What they didn't know was that the reactionary mullahs standing behind them would then seize power from them. And the Ayatollah Khomeini then took the country over, and he took the organization that introduced democracy, and he murdered it. He murdered perhaps a million people in different prisons, mostly young people, and all idealistic and optimistic. One of these was this young school teacher. Well, he survived. They murdered. His father was a cleric, a Muslim cleric in Iran, not far from Tehran. But he was too eminent for them to attack when he opposed them, so they went for his sons.
Wow.
They put two of them in prison, my client and his older brother. They murdered another. A fourth son ran away to join the guerrillas somewhere else. And they took my client, and they beat and they beat and they beat him, but they still didn't get what they wanted, and in fact he had no information for them. So they put his brother into a cell with some wild cats, and they made him watch these wild cats kill his brother.
Wow.
Now, it's hard to imagine a torture as appalling as this, but these are the kind of stories I've been exposed to in the work I do for decades now. What I want to share with you is the state this man was in when he was brought to see me by another brother of his who was here in London. His brother was the interpreter. They were very educated people. The brother was running a very interesting electronics business in this country. And my client was able to get a permit to come and join his brother for a wedding, which is how he got out of the country.
Hmm.
And he was brought to me in a state we call now complex PTSD, complex post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
Now, I think I was in this sort of state myself for a good deal of the time I was in prison. He couldn't conduct a conversation. His words didn't come out in any conversational manner. He had no capacity to be orientated, so he would lose track of where he was. If he started talking to you, he would get so agitated that he would fall off his chair. He chain-smoked. He couldn't sleep properly, and during the day, he couldn't keep awake. This was a very grim, gross, and traumatized picture. What had brought him to this state was that whilst he was here for his older brother's wedding, the father had died at home of a heart attack. And that's exactly what the Revolutionary Guard wanted to happen. And this brought him back to the state he was in when he came out of prison. So I started seeing him every day for the first few weeks until he was calmer, and then every week. And so it went for a year and a half. Regular, systematic, and containing psychotherapy. And then he joined one of my therapy groups, and he was in the group for several years. He's now a very successful man. He joined his older brother's business. He married an English girl who converted to Islam. They have three grown-up children. This is a story that goes back a long way.
Yeah, yeah.
What I want to share with you about the light is what he said to me at the end of the first phase of his treatment, when he left the individual sessions we were doing and he came to join my group. And he said two stories that I'll share with you. The one is that at a point in this terrible place called Evin Prison, it's the big main prison in Tehran, they put him in a punishment cell on the top of the prison because he was persistently teaching fellow inmates. And he wasn't supposed to be teaching. He was a teacher. So they put him in the punishment cell, and there was another old man there, he told me, an old peasant who they kept beating, even worse than they beat him. And one day he went to the old peasant and he said, "Old man, we can't beat them back." The old man wanted to try and go for the guards, and he cautioned him and he said, "Nothing we can do. But whilst we're here, I'm going to teach you to read and to write, and that will be our victory against them." Now, this was the one lesson I had from him. The next came when we said goodbye to each other. And to say thank you, he said to me, "Yours is the hand of humanity that reaches out to save me from drowning in my sorrow. And it's hearing such statements of renewal and regeneration that's given me renewed faith and helps me continue with the work I do.
Wow, absolutely profound. My final question for you in the little time that we have left, and I promise you I could chat you all the way through to midnight, but before I ask my final question, I have to ask you this before I forget. We have a feature called Voices and Choices at the end of the show, in that final hour. What is the one song that I could play for you, even if you're not listening, and hopefully you would be, but that really resonates with you, so that at least we can kick off that hour on that note?
Oh, without doubt, it's Senzanina.
Senzanina. I will definitely make sure that we find it. I think that for me is absolutely fitting. But just as my final question to you, I mean, talking about trauma, talking about PTSD, I'm sure if you had to look at South Africa, and diagnose us with events from this past week, going back all the way to what happened way before 1994. In fact, I think we can go all the way back to 1652. I'm sure that you will agree with me that we deeply traumatized, a deeply angry nation. What mindset, if such a thing exists, do we need to adopt to be able to cope with this? Because it's gender-based violence, it's crime, and violence wherever you look.
Well, I regard myself as a South African. It's the only country I feel I really belong to. It's where I was born, and it's what I carry within me. But it's a strange country, because, as you say, layer upon layer upon layer of injury and terrible violence. One of the people who was arrested at the same time as me is our contemporary poet laureate, Wally Mongane Serote. Mm-hmm. And when, some years back, when Freedom Park was opened, and I saw a program, this was during the presidential administration of Thabo Mbeki, I think it was towards the end of his time in office, and they were opening Freedom Park. And I saw that when they went to go and visit those, I haven't yet been there myself, when I saw that they went to visit these different features of the park itself, they took their shoes and socks off out of respect for the site they were visiting. And the site gave tribute to the lives of the Khoi and the San people. And those hurt and injured in pre-colonial wars in the country. And I thought to myself, this action taken from blacks themselves to bring restitution and dignity to the people who've passed before, this is a voice not only that looks backwards, but it also looks towards a better future.
It's very profound, and I wish that, we can find it in ourselves. I'm thinking about what you're saying there and how you yourself, and I think you're really sort of underestimating the role that you're playing, and I think that's what makes you someone that's not self-serving. But ultimately, the switch that you made in being able to grant amnesty of the soul to the people that did what they did to you is something that we need to adopt in this country. And I think, I was looking right at the beginning of our interview. A WhatsApp came through and someone accused you of being a race baiter. Stop that race baiter. And the thing for me about it is, it's exactly that you seemingly, John, come across as someone that has a different point of view to me, and therefore I dislike you and I'm not willing to listen to what you have to say. And unfortunately, that's the space that we're in. Because for a person to be able to take off their shoes and their socks and to walk barefoot in memory, in remembrance of those that we've left behind. It's a clear indication of saying that, listen, I'm not above it all. I'm not the only victim. In fact, I'm not the sole victim, that there were many that were impacted and affected. And I think that is when we will truly reconcile as a nation. And it's very difficult at this stage, I think.
It's a hard time. And this pandemic has created catastrophic conditions for so many people.
Hmm.
It's a tragedy for the country and so many of its people.
As a final thought, in the 3 minutes that you and I have left, you know, the book, if you can just remind us of the title, where people can get it, and why did it take you 52 years to write it? I mean, you know, it's a few years much older than me.
Yeah. Well, it's called When They Came For Me. It's published in South Africa by Jonathan Ball Publishers. You can order copies through Exclusive Books or any retail outlet. You can also order it from Amazon, but there's no reason to make George Bezos wealthy if you can buy it in South Africa. The edition you would get from Amazon is the edition in which it first came out,
mm-hmm.
published by a UK-based company called Berkan Books. They were my first publisher.
Wow. Okay.
And then they assigned rights for this book to the South African readership, to Jonathan Ball Publishers. And between these two publishing houses, they really helped me a lot with the drafting of it. But if I explain to you that in order to write this book about 55 days, the 3 years I spent writing it were 3 years spent inside a prison cell.
Mm.
Now, you don't voluntarily and willingly enter into a place of darkness. You need strength to do so.
Yeah.
So I had to write my first book first, the one about the practice of psychotherapy.
Mm-hmm.
And only when that gave me the strength and confidence to go back into the horror could I do this. And that's the principal reason it took so long. There are many other factors too, but that's the principal reason.
Well, I really do thank you for gifting us, you know, that and obviously all the work that you have done. And I understand. I mean, as you said, it's literally like going back into that cell and reliving all of those horrors over that 55-day period. And it's something that happened in your youth, but it stays with you for the rest of your life. But I think that you're the ultimate model of you, from my perspective, the ultimate model for humanity. I mean, and grace. Being able to move past all of that and be the person you are today. Absolutely stunning conversation I had with you. Thank you so much. Again, I will say this, 10 years after of doing talk radio, you're definitely in amongst the top interviews I've ever done, at least in the top three interviews I've ever done. Thank you so much.
I'm honored and touched, and I know of your own human rights work, so this means a lot to hear you say that.
Thank you. I'm absolutely flattered to hear that you even bothered looking into that. So I really appreciate it.
I've been following your work, and I admire and value what you do.
Thank you.
And honor your own contribution.
No, thank you.
Thank you very much.
So before I start tearing up, thank you so much. All the best to you.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
Thank you. Absolute stunning conversation. I can't wait for the podcast. That's one I'm saving. I'm keeping it on a golden disc somewhere.